now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is a podcast from The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Welcome to The Game, the podcast with the fitness levels to power through the festive fixture frenzy. I'm Guy Marcotti, and with Ben Smith and James Ducker in my midfield, plus I've sneaked in before the transfer window officially opens, and signed Rory K. Smith to add some flair. Welcome, Rory.
Country gap.
This is the introduction. Don't speak during the introduction. He's got some things to learn yet. Later on, we'll be debating whether the FA should do its job a little bit quicker, especially those folks on the disciplinary panel. But first, let's start with Manchester City and Arsenal. Now, Ducker, I want to go straight to you because I you know how I feel about Premier League hype, but this actually was, I thought, the best Premier League game I've seen this season, or pretty darn close to it. What made it so good?
It was pretty absorbing, compelling. I think technically it was pretty good too. I think Arsenal surprised a lot of people. They looked at that defensive lineup with four centre halves in it, and I think a lot of people thought, "Ooh, hang on a minute, they could be in for a difficult day." And yet they surprised a lot of people and matched City in a lot of departments. I thought it was quite an untypical Premier League game. Gab in so many ways, you know, there was a lot of entertainment, but it wasn't just kind of throwing caution to the wind and reckless abandon everywhere. It was, I thought both teams approached it pretty intelligently. I just felt if Walcott and Jovino had maybe offered a bit more on the flanks and a bit more support to Van Persie, they could have asked City a few more questions than they ultimately did in the end.
Roy, you like your foreign football. You're going to tell me that it was a good game because there were only three Englishmen in the starting 11s of the two teams combined?
I think you probably could make that point. I agree with James. I think it didn't look like that sort of normal gung-ho, blood-and-thunder Premier League nonsense fest. I was at QPR yesterday, and that's exactly what that was. Just two teams without midfield going at each other. City-Arsenal looked a bit more cagey. Arsenal, I think, have changed. There's been a massive evolution in Arsenal the last sort of 2 months. They've developed a team spirit and a bond, and that shone through yesterday.
Ben, we talked about the four centre halves. Obviously, that's not by choice. That's by necessity, given the injuries to Andre Santos and Bakary Sagna and Kieran Gibbs, and of course Jenkinson too. Right? Is he injured or is he just not good?
He's injured.
He is injured. Okay.
Also not good.
That's not very nice. But what struck me was I thought Wenger had his game plan right to go there, but was it a case of just City are better? And also, was Mancini justified afterwards? I saw him interviewed on TV, and he's like, well, I wasn't happy with the fact that we took the lead and then we were still so open and we tried to go forward and score and blah, blah, blah.
I think City were better, but not that much better. I think, as you say, Arsenal were forced into that situation with the four centre-backs, and that probably cost them for the goal in the end when Kaczelny was sucked in a bit and Balotelli broke down the left. But I think while Arsenal were beaten, I think there's so much they can take out of their game. I think they caused City as many problems as probably any team we've seen at the Etihad all season. There was some great goalkeeping on both sides, but especially Joe Hart in the second half. And on your point about Mancini, I mean, City have played like that all season. They've always gone for the second goal. They've always tried to kill teams off. And so I think while Mancini probably does need to have a little bit more caution in some situations, I think there was an argument yesterday they could go and get that second goal. I mean, they looked like they could have scored it, but you know, long may it continue, as far as I'm concerned.
Ducker, you know where I'm going with this, okay? Because Ben just said, you know, Mancini maybe should need a little bit more caution. This is the same Mancini who was absolutely crucified in, you know, after taking over from Sparky for his defensive tactics and the three holding midfielders and all this rubbish. Now, I'm not going to be mean and go back on a Google in the archives and see who wrote what, because somebody else will do it about some of the many stupid things I've written. But if somebody wanted to do that, it would be an absolute bloodbath, right, for you City watchers?
Yeah, it's funny. The Manchester reporters were talking about that the other day, because we were all kind of scratching our brains to see if we had been ultra critical of his defensive approach, and we weren't.
You say you weren't?
A lot of us were saying at that time, when he kind of came in, that the big problem that they had under Mark Hughes is that, you know, they might score three goals, but they'll ship four. And Mancini made it his priority when he kind of came in to address the defensive shortcomings first and foremost. And he did that largely by separating Lescott and Touré, and who were too similar, you know, two kind of, I suppose, both like to kind of bring the ball out from the back and pair company with Touré or company with Lescott. And obviously fielded the two kind of holding midfield players in front of him. And, you know, it made a huge, huge, huge difference, and I think he should be applauded for doing that. I mean, you know, it had to be a situation that was addressed. I mean, speaking to kind of David Platt about this, he said that was our focus. And then after that, we began to address the, you know, the attacking kind of elements of the team. But what is the point in having a great attack if the foundations behind them are flimsy? And obviously they've juggled things around at the front six, obviously brought some kind of key players in, and you're seeing a far better balance now. You're completely right, Gav. There was a kind of a collective kind of bashing of Mancini for this perceived negativity. I remember speaking to quite a few journalists in Italy, and they were just absolutely perplexed by it. But now things are kind of coming around, and people are like, oh, you know, it was a master plan, you know, he's done exactly right. And he stuck to his guns, and we're starting to see the benefits of that now.
I was somewhat perplexed by that myself, because, you know, if somebody looked at Mancini's body of work, the way his Lazio teams play, the way his Inter Milan teams play, played certainly at first before they got Ibrahimovic, it was sort of an attacking, progressive team. But Rory, I want to ask you, because it's sometimes difficult to judge what a manager brings when he's got all these absurdly good players. If I was to substitute Mancini with... Actually, let me phrase the question this way. There's 19 other managers in the Premier League. If I was to substitute Mancini with every single one of them in turn, how many of those other guys would be top of the table now?
I think... with that squad, a lot, to be honest. Yeah, I mean... the
more than half?
And probably not Steve Keane, probably not Owen Coyle, but yeah, I mean the better managers.
Tony,
yeah.
Pulis?
No, wouldn't have thought so. No,
Harry
probably would be. Yeah, I would imagine Harry would be. Mancini, I think is an excellent manager. I think the reason that he's sort of typecast as defensive initially is because he's Italian. We associate Italians with defensive football. It's sort of a 2+2 thing.
Because Enrico Sacchi was Dutch, obviously.
Yeah. But you I think that's fair to say that English people think Italian football is defensive, and right, therefore when you have an Italian manager, we
assume Ancelotti is Chinese, of course. Yes,
well, half. Yeah, I think Mancini is crucial to that, and I think the way you can tell that Mancini is crucial, despite the fact that a lot of managers would succeed with that squad, is James Milner. James Milner looks three or four times the player he was before Mancini got hold of him. And I mean, I've never particularly liked Milner, but he is now a cultured, effective, energetic midfield player, and that's testament to Mancini.
And what about Gareth Barry, Rory?
Yeah, exactly.
Gareth Barry has been absolutely outstanding this season. Technically, his kind of use and delivery and distribution of the ball has been absolutely brilliant. You know, I mean, he had a great, I think he had a really good start under Hughes, and then he went terribly off the boil. But the Barry I am seeing playing for Man City this season, I have just not seen that player for England. And obviously it's clearly got a hell of a lot to do with what he's got around him, but you know, it is not like watching an English midfielder.
I want to ask you about Barry, because if you remember when he was at Villa with O'Neill, he played, I mean, I thought he played extremely well, and there was a sense that, you know, the next big thing. And remember, there was the whole business with Rafa wanting him and whatnot. But he was playing alongside a real holding midfielder, or a guy who was playing that role in Stylian Petrov. And then he moves to City and he plays alongside De Jong. This season, though, he is the holding midfielder, right? I mean, him, it's most of the year, you know, De Jong's not been in there, James, and it's been Nasri, Yaya Touré, and Barry. So he's actually adapted more to that holding role where he struggled with England. How did that happen? Because he's still not particularly, I mean, he can pass a little, but he's still not pretty, and he's intelligent, but he's still not particularly quick.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, going back to that earlier point, that kind of, you know, defensive base of the two midfielders, you know, Mancini's taken the decision not to really use De Jong much this season, and Yaya Touré alongside Barry has been given license to really push on and support, you know, the players in front of him, and that, you know, by extension has obviously resulted in Barry having to kind of screen the defence more, to have to sit. You've started to see, you know, Silva, you know, Nasri, Touré, they'll pass the ball to Barry when he's got a man right on top of him, or he's got a couple of people around him and not much space to move in, and he looks relaxed, you know, receiving the ball in those areas. And that's a very, very un-English trait. I mean, we're terrible for receiving the ball under pressure and losing it.
Three housekeeping points before we move on to Wigan and Chelsea. One, just to get this out of the way before we get a lot of hate mail. Anybody want to argue that should have been a penalty on Micah Richards for the handball?
Well, it doesn't say it in the laws, does it? It's not deliberate.
So it's not a penalty?
No.
Okay, clear. So we're all in agreement on that one. Two, Mario Balotelli, because I haven't mentioned him yet on this show, and we need to give him a plug every single show contractually. The third point, though, I want to raise this with you, Ben, is, and anybody else, feel free to chime in. Gary Jacob reporting in Saturday's Times that Arsenal hadn't ruled out the possibility of signing Thierry Henry on loan. Now, I'll grant you, Barnett haven't ruled out that possibility either, and nobody's asked them, but I just want to get from you, given the situation where, you know, let's say that Walcott was pretty poor at the weekend, he's what he is. Park Chu-young, I think, is a decent player. He hasn't shown it at all here. Shamak's been terrible. Arshavin is counting down the days until he gets out of prison, June 30th, 2012. I think it's about 190-odd days now. Unless Martin O'Neill decides he's had enough of Nicholas Bentner and his window-smashing antics and sends him back to Arsenal, they kind of need somebody up front. Would a two-month solution, especially given the that Gervinho and Schumacher are going to go to the African Cup of Nations, does that excite you? Would that be a good idea? Or should we read that as kind of evidence that, damn, Arsenal really don't have any money to spend whatsoever, and they got to go back to the man whose statue is outside the Emirates?
It excites me. I think it makes sense in lots of ways for Arsenal. And so, you know, this is a guy who's training with them at the moment, has been for the past month, and by all accounts is on fire in training and looked as sharp as he ever has. He knows the squad. He knows Wenger. He would fit in very well, I think. And as you say, with Gervinho away, Shamak away, you know, it is an easy solution for them. And as you say, it's also an effective one in terms of finance. It makes sense to me.
Roderick, is it likely to happen? Would it be a good idea, or would it kind of...
Thank you, Gabriele. I don't know how likely it is to happen. It seems to be, yeah, as you say, on Saturday the reports were that...
Would it be a good idea?
Would it, is it a good idea?
Or should you maybe say, like, well, you know, we just spent money on Joel Campbell, maybe we look at whether he can play, or maybe we actually spend some of the money we'll be saving on our Arshavin when he finally goes back to Leningrad, or St. Petersburg for the uninitiated.
Generally, it's better to look at the future than the past. But then, do you not... I don't know, there's an element that with Henri, maybe it could have a galvanising effect. He's an iconic figure. The players all know him. He was there not that long ago. So, I don't know, my gut instinct is no, it's a bad idea. It's English football being particularly atavistic and slightly stupid. But in this one instance, maybe it might have some merit. I'd still be inclined to go out and sign a striker who wasn't 34.
I think what Rory's saying is this is a guy who brings more than just what he brings on the pitch. You know, the effect he could have in the dressing room, the example he provide for the younger players, and the galvanising effect that he could bring to that dressing room is probably worth more than just a guy who might come in on loan from somewhere else.
But then, under Van Persie's captaincy, Arsenal's... This is the team spirit, the bond that Arsenal sort of displayed at Man City. That, by all accounts, according to people who know these things, is because of the way Robin van Persie has been as a captain. His wife, Boucher, is friends with a lot of the other players' wives and girlfriends. He's organising social events. Fabregas never did that. Henri never did that when they were captain. There is now a bond at Arsenal. Maybe Henri, for all he's a great player, represents certain traits in Arsenal that they should be glad to be rid of.
All right, the ball's definitely in Wenger's course with this one. My personal two cents, and in case he cares, is I would not go for Podolski, though. All right, let's move up north to the stadium formerly known as the JJB Sports Arena. Is that what it was? Or the JJB?
Just the JJB.
Just the JJB, yeah. And now known as the DW. Wonder where he got that idea. So Chelsea are go up the wing. A lot of people said, "Oh, look, we've turned the corner. Mini revival. Look, we beat City." I didn't get a chance because that game took place after a podcast. But I wasn't impressed with their performance against City. I liked the result, but you know, you're against 10 men. There were periods after that where they're at home and they're not seeing the ball. And I was really curious to know, are we going to see the low block, as he likes to call it, which is everybody sit back and boot the ball up to Sturridge and Drogba, or were we going to see, you know, the more sort of progressive football that we saw when he was at Porto? What happened at Wigan?
He's caught between two stools, isn't he, Fias Boas? The low block is basically where John Terry wants to stand, and that's where John Terry tells everyone to stand, and the high line, which is where Fias Boas wants everyone to play, but it doesn't suit any of his players. So he's in this weird sort of purgatory between reality and his ideals. And at the moment, it just doesn't work. I agree with you. I thought they weren't great against City. I think City took their foot off the pedal completely after the goal, maybe the first 20 minutes, and then allowed Chelsea back into it. And at Wigan, yeah, I mean, they were unlucky. Petacek is doing his best to display why he's not the goalkeeper he used to be. But Wigan's one of those places. They're not dreadful, Wigan. They're not Blackburn. They're not Bolton. And they can always nick a goal if they're relatively solid at the back.
I think, I mean, you've got Caldwell and people like that at the back. There's a reason why they're in the bottom three. You would expect Chelsea with the investment. This is a Chelsea team that finished first and second the last 2 years, and that since then has added and spent a tremendous amount of money. Isn't it legitimate that they could go to Wigan and put on a slightly better show?
Oh, yeah, they should be winning. They should be playing well. But the way that Chelsea have been this season, I don't think you should necessarily expect them to be the sort of more than the sum of their parts. And at the moment, their parts are aging and slightly shaky.
James, riddle me this. It's halftime. It's 0-0. And Lilis Boas takes off Romeo, who is his deep-lying midfielder, and who... You know, we were certainly given the indication that he was the key to everything, protecting the two center halves. And he sends on Solomon Kalou, and then moves Mata behind the striker. So, you know, all of a sudden, it's a very different team. It's a formation he hasn't really played before, because his two in midfield at that point became Lampard and Mayrelish. I think that's all good, and then they score. And then, boom, back in comes Mikel and Malouda for Sturridge. I mean, it's certainly unorthodox, right?
Yeah, I've been trying to. I was looking at it and scratching my head in a very puzzled manner.
I can just picture just, you with a very puzzled look on your face, scratching your head.
It's just like it hints at kind of just a bit of incoherent thinking, doesn't it? Really, I mean, I cannot for the life of me. I mean, firstly, I think hinted at just a lack of patience. I think really, you know, Wigan are always going to present you with opportunities in front of goal. It's just the way they can't defend. So losing Romeo at half time just didn't really kind of make much sense. Even more so when you then go 1-0 up and you bring another defensive midfield player on, particularly, you know, for your best schema. It just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. I've tried to kind of work out what he was thinking, and I just don't really get it. And it backfired, and then obviously then he made another daft substitution by taking his best attacker off 10 minutes from time.
But James, I think it was clear to me there that, you know, for barring a period of 20 minutes in the first half, Chelsea never had a grip on that game, not once. And for all their chances in the first half, the odd shot here and there, there was never really a sense that they had got the game by the scruff of the neck.
If you've not got the game by the scruff of the neck, Ben, surely you don't take off your midfield linchpin.
I'm not justifying the decision. I think he was wrong. And talking to Petr Cech after the game, he was the only player who stopped to talk to us after the game, and he said in the past we would have gone 0-0 at half time, we would have scored two goals, and we probably would have ended up with six. And you know, that was the feeling. That is what Chelsea used to do to teams. And looking at that side now, they just can't do it. The confidence isn't there, the ability isn't there anymore, which is a real worry, I think. And they just lack coherence in everything they do. It's something that that, as Rory says, this is caught between two stools here. Villas-Boas either needs to get this team by the scruff of the neck and absolutely thrust his vision on them, or he needs to sit back and let the players take over, because at the moment it's neither one thing nor the other.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome. Like, what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome. Like, what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello.
Yeah, I don't know about being able to thrust his vision. I mean, I have a lot. You can't really justify the substitutions, but I've got a lot of sympathy for Villas-Boas, generally speaking. I mean, half of that team was still, you know, Mourinho's team. They are paying the price for the impatience of their owner. I mean, you know, they had seven changes of manager in 8 years,
James,
or something.
James, you know, I don't allow that statistic, because that is the kind of misleading BS statistic that gives us in the media a bad name. The reality is, since Mourinho arrived, there's only three managers who were actually, you know, sacked, although they would call it mutual consent, but obviously we know they were let go. And that's Scolari, Ancelotti, and obviously Mourinho himself. So when people put the seven managers, blah, 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 it's not really fair, because Avram Grant was always an interim guy, and Goose Hiddink was always an interim guy.
Yeah, but Gab, you can't ignore that, because the time Grant was in place and Hiddink was in place, it's kind of time that a permanent manager could have had to try and shape his ideas on the team and regenerate, give the manager a little bit of time to then, you know, see that through. I mean, there's been none of that there. There's been no opportunity for them to you know, think long and hard about it and, you know, plan for the future. I mean, the key words aren't these days are succession planning, but there's been none of that at Chelsea.
I think Villas-Boas does want to imprint his vision on that side, but he needs a summer to do that. You can't do that in January. You can't do it last summer.
Partially through the summer, Rory.
At least the summer. He couldn't do that last summer through his own fault, because he decided to give the older players another chance. That was his decision.
Do you believe that? That it was his decision to do that?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I think he was offered the choice by Emanalo as to whether he wanted
to try Emanalo? Emanalo's his boss now.
Well, Emanalo's got Abramovich's ear. There's no question about that. Don't ask me how, but that appears to be the case. That Emanalo is a man with power at Chelsea.
This is what's so demented and dysfunctional about this club, is that, and this happened last season too, is nobody talks in public except for the manager, and everything gets dumped on the manager. And so Villas-Boas has to sit there and talk about, you know, what he thinks John Terry might have said to Anton Ferdinand, whereas in a normal world, if this was United, I mean, that's a bit different, obviously Fergie's there, but like, you would assume that Gil would be talking and putting out that we are the face of the club. Here, all the questions are dumped on the manager, and it's absolutely even stuff that he's got nothing to do with. I mean, Ben, you were there. Did anybody ask him about the substitutions afterwards?
Yeah, and he freely admitted that he'd come to take a 1-0. That was his plan. He wanted to hang on for the last 20 minutes. He openly admitted that in the press conference afterwards, that he you know, they'd gone 1-0 up, and he was satisfied with that. They were going to try and hang on to what they got, and that just isn't. This is Chelsea. This is Wigan v Chelsea. You know, Chelsea don't do that at places like Wigan. That's not something we've ever become used to.
But this is what Chelsea does to managers. You looked at Villas-Boas when he came, the principles, the tenets of his philosophy of football, the rotating midfield, he's abandoned that. The high line, he's abandoned that. Constant pressure, constantly going forward, as Ben says, he's abandoned that.
You can't press with these strikers.
No, exactly.
That's the thing. I mean, how are you going to press with Sturridge and Mata?
Well, yeah, no, or Drogba or Lampard or whoever. There's players who can do it. Ramirez and Morelos can do it, I think. But
no, but I'm talking about the front men. Like,
yeah,
it's not the game.
But he's had to abandon all of these ideas that he has that sort of defined his football at Porto because of Chelsea. This is what Chelsea does. Chelsea is a sort of unmoving, unchanging object, and managers are powerless in its wake.
But Rory, going to Wigan to accept a one, you know, to go for a 1-0, as Ben said, against a team that scored 9 goals at home and 6 away, is a pretty...
Chelsea, you know, the last 3 games, it was 15-0 to Chelsea, the last 3 games against Wigan. And here's a guy going for a 1-0.
Well, I'm not accepting that Franco Di Santo is anything other than a deadly striker.
Enough Chelsea. How about we praise Wigan a little bit? Because what struck me was, I'm watching the game on TV, and I was curious to see how Roberto Martinez was going to approach it. And I thought, like, by playing Salmon, who's not a real striker, or certainly, you know, very mobile, and Moses up front, I'm you know, instead of Rodallega or indeed De Santo, I was struck, it kind of left Chelsea's back four wondering, like, hey, where are these guys, and they're all sort of moving around and whatever else. I also thought kind of blanking. Who was the wide midfield? Was it Jones? I'm thinking.
He was kind of playing as a wing, left wing back.
Right. He got a little bit overrun, but I understand the idea of why he was there and what he was trying to do. But I don't know. What did you make of Wigan? I mean, Martinez sort of. Should we be giving him credit beyond the pretty passing? It looked like there was some tactical thought there, and then after having these two guys running around everywhere, you know, he put on the strikers.
Yeah, I thought it was very clever what he did, actually, with his attacking shape. I think he'd obviously seen Chelsea vulnerable to movement and pace off a front man, and by giving Moses a license to run off Sam, he caused them all sorts of problems, both in the first half and the second half, and probably could have scored twice himself. And at the back, he played 3 defenders with 2 wing backs, and actually that's what cost Wigan in the end for the goal. I mean, Cole found a pass, and Sturridge managed to get between Jones and Figueroa row and got some space there. That was the only place where they slightly got exposed. But Martinez does deserve credit. I think he said he really, you could see he'd thought about how to get at Chelsea, and it worked.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating to see what you can do with players who are so ostensibly of low quality. Connor Salmon, I think someone on Twitter said, looks like he's taking part in an elaborate Faking It documentary where a painter and decorator gets to be a Premier League footballer. But you can, if you think about it, you can stop the teams that have much more quality. Three at the back, I don't understand why people don't do it more. And there's not, the other thing I'd like to say just very quickly, there's not nearly enough tactical difference in England. You look at Italy, there's managers playing hugely different formations all the time. It doesn't happen in England. Everyone plays basically 4-5-1 or 4-3-3 when you've got the ball. That's all we play in it.
I disagree a tiny bit on the quality point. I know I'm in the minority there, but I mean, I think ultimately it's about having players who can fit what you want to do. I mean, I think James McCarthy is a phenomenally gifted player, and who's British, by the way, as is Figueroa. Is also a very good player. The thing is, they maybe have shortcomings in other departments, and obviously Moses as well, but you're spot on about the tactical variance, and I think, but it also takes players who are willing to listen to you through long, boring tactical sessions. I remember your mate Platy telling me that when he was at Forest, he tried to have the kind of tactical sessions he had when, you know, earlier in his career when he was in Italy, and sort of after about 15 minutes, you know, the players, like, they started getting glassy-eyed and they weren't paying attention to him anymore, and he said, all right, screw this, let's go 4-4-2 and two banks of four and let's get at him. Final point. Percentage chance of Wigan staying up, please.
I'll say 60%. I fancy them to stay up.
I really like Roberto as a manager and as a bloke. 25%, I think it's one of four will survive them, Wolves, Bolton and Blackburn.
Ducker?
So, I'll go with 25% as well. I dearly love him to stay up. He's one of the nicest blokes in football, and as Rory says, he does think about it, but I do fear for them, I'm afraid.
Roberto Martinez, you're this week's Warrior of the Light. Okay, right. In our debate this week, we're gonna talk a little bit about Suarez, Evra, and perhaps Terry Ferdinand. There was a verdict that we were all expecting on Friday. Now it's been moved. The verdict might be out there by the time that you listen to this podcast. But what I'm interested in is why this whole thing is taking so freaking long. Now, Ollie Kay, who isn't on the show, tweeted, well, it's much more important that they get this verdict right and they should take all the time that they need. Something to that effect. I'm sure he'll correct me afterwards. And he's not the only one. And I have to say, like, Ducker, I don't agree with him at all. I don't know what the mechanism here for the investigation, but it seems to me there's a finite number of people to speak to. You've had more than 2 months. The Suarez case anyway, you don't even have the excuse of police involvement and all this other crap to slow you down. So for 2 months, we've had two people's names being dragged through the mud by one side or the other side. Can you understand why it's taken so long? You have insight into the mechanisms?
I've obviously covered the story a bit, and I'm with you on it, Gab. I think it's ludicrous how long it's taken. I have routinely asked the question to people behind the scenes about why it has taken so long, and no one has been able to give anything approaching kind of a reasonable answer, really. All I can surmise is that the situation is very sensitive, and I can't remember the FA just being so kind of cagey about a case. I mean, there's next to no briefing on it. They just seem very, very anxious about the whole thing. And I can only surmise that they are being very, very deliberate in what they're doing, in the hope of not making any mistake whatsoever, and ensuring that every kind of stone is unturned. And even if it's a case of going over and over and over the same things again and again and again, to ensure that, you know, once they arrived at this place, this situation at the hearing, that, you know, everything was suitably in place. I don't have a problem about the actual hearing itself taking, you know, more than, you know, a few days. I think it convened on Wednesday, didn't it? And, you know, look, if it's you know, today or tomorrow that the arrival verdict, that's fine. But 2 months to get to this stage. But, it's not a surprise, though, Gav. I mean, the FA seem to... You know, some things you'd expect to take a while to deal with very swiftly, and then other things drag on and on and on forever. And, you know, and there's lots of situations, particularly where, you know, some of the outbursts at referees, you know, you've seen situations where it's been 2 or 3 months down the line before the variety of a verdict. And obviously this is a similar situation to that. And there's no real consistency over timescales with, you know, disciplinary matters at the FA. But I fear that 2, 3, 4 years from now, we'll be having the same debate.
Well, to be fair to the FA, I guess we can't really say it's the FA, like in the sense of Horn and Bernstein, because I'm assuming that they have certain guidelines they follow, and it's not like David Bernstein sits in these meetings and says, hey, let's go and drag this out forever. But it's these three people involved now. Roy, I want you to think that there's some sense that they've spent a very long time sort of not so much establishing what Suarez may or may not have said, but whether it's offensive, and obviously the term he might have used might have been a Spanish one, and what's appropriate, what's not appropriate. It seems to me like they're almost trying to set up a precedent to have some guidelines so that, you know, if I swear at you using language which might not be offensive in my country but which is offensive in this country, then we'll deal with it this way and not that way. Does that make sense to you, that that's what they're trying to do? They're trying to actually not just legislate this case, but make legislation.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's very easy for all of us to criticise the FA, and normally, or on a lot of occasions, they kind of deserve it. But on this one, they've essentially got to choose between which culture is better, Hispanic culture or English linguistic culture. And it's an impossible... I really don't envy them with this one, but it's an impossible thing to decide. The best parallel, I suppose, that someone suggested to me was, if you're foreign and you come across here... And
which
you,
I am.
Which you are, famously. And you come across here and drive on the wrong side of the road, and you're pulled over by the police, and do they say to you, you're driving on the wrong side of the road, when you say, sorry, I'm foreign, I didn't know, is that a legitimate excuse? Because that's... Suarez has admitted, as far as we can tell, using the word negro, not negro, negro, which is something entirely different to what English people understand by the word negro. Now, his defence will be that in Hispanic culture, it's not offensive. It's not. You only have to read Danny Pacheco's tweets to realise it's not offensive in Spain.
To be fair, Danny Pacheco, when he tweets to other Spanish speakers. Patrice Evra, he's not Luis Suarez's mate.
Yep.
And secondly, he doesn't speak Spanish.
Yeah, and the other argument is...
But he does speak Italian, and in Italian it has a slightly different meaning.
The other argument with Suarez is he should know. He's lived in Holland, which is a hugely multicultural, multiracial society. And yeah, as I say, you say he should know. So do you punish him and ban him for 10 games and fine him $50,000? Or do you say, well, he's Spanish, so it's kind of fine. He didn't mean it racially. And I think we have to kind of accept that Suarez, in an ostensible sense, is not a racist. He plays with black players for his club, for his country, for his former clubs. He's never said, you know what, right. You're a black lad, I'm not playing.
You're right.
With you.
If you work with a black person, then clearly you can't be a racist. Thank you, Rory.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
I understand what you're saying.
He's not like a Klan member. Do you know what I mean? He's not.
Right.
He's not actively racist. Yeah. He's just...
I don't even know if the Klan exists in this country, but I'm sure there are alternative.
Probably does in Yorkshire.
I think we'll leave it there before we get Yorkshire. Did you say I'll get put Matt Hughes on your rear end? All right. How about some quick hits? And this is Rory K. Smith's debut. So we'll all be patient with him. Michael Carrick scores a gorgeous goal, his first since the beginning of time. Rory, why can't Carrick be the creative central midfielder Ferguson so badly needs?
Because his technique is wanting, because he doesn't score enough goals, he doesn't have an eye for a killer pass, and he doesn't control the tempo of a game particularly well. He's an average midfielder, Carrick, who has moments of being quite good.
Well, good thing he's locked up through 2014 then. Speaking of Sir Alex Ferguson, Roy Keane revealed yesterday in the Sunday Times that after he left United and gave an interview in which he criticised the club for the way his exit exit was handled. He got one of those threatening, nasty legal letters from that human pond scum we call lawyers. Now, they said that Roy Keane needed to issue a full apology and promise never to criticize the club ever again. Keane told Brabner's, Chafe, and Street to crawl back under their rocks, and obviously didn't do anything about it, but was deeply wounded and upset. James, are you surprised by this whole issue?
No, because it wasn't coming from United. It was obviously very much at the prompting of Sir Alex Ferguson, which, you know, Keane made pretty clear in his interview. As he said, you know, as he pointed out about the McManus Magnier spat, you know, Fergie hates being slighted, and he obviously felt slighted in the situation, and he's gone after Keane. That's what this is about.
Tottenham get the 3 points over Martin O'Neill's Sunderland, but lose Aaron Lennon. Ben, they're already without Gareth Bale, not to mention Michael Dawson. Are Spurs really a credible title threat? Or are we just being nice to Harry?
I think we have to take them seriously, but I think injuries are a factor here. I think if they were to lose one more of Modric, Adebayor, Parker, they'd be in trouble. So they are until that happens, I think.
Modric, Adebayor, Parker, notice how he doesn't mention Thunder Fart. Liverpool cruise to a comfortable 2-0 win over strikerless Aston Villa. No offense to Emil Heskey and Nathan Delfonso. Rory, I ask everybody this, so don't be offended, but where on God's green earth will King Kenny squeeze in Steven Gerrard when he's back, if he's back?
Alongside Charlie Adam and Jordan Henderson in central midfield while Lucas Leiva is injured. I think longer term there's a problem, but at the moment there is a gap there. Liverpool lack a sort of controlling presence in midfield that sadly Jonjo Shelvey just can't fill.
Good news, Stevie G. Landon Donovan will return to the Premier League, joining Everton on loan for 2 months. James, Davy Moyes' crew were held by Norwich 1-1 at the weekend. What do they need Donovan for? I mean, is it to finish mid-table so they can avoid finishing mid-table?
It's really put your back up this, hasn't it, Gal? I think, to be honest as well, I think Moyes will be looking over his shoulder. There are only 4 points above the relegation zone. There's no guarantee yet of mid-table.
There's about 100 teams beneath them, Ducker.
You what, sorry?
There's about 100 teams beneath them, Ducker. Most of them managed by Muppets.
The 14th, 4 points off the bottom, and they've lost 7 of the last 11.
All right, I guess I have more faith in St. Davy Moyes than you do.
I would stake my mortgage or whatever on Moyes kind of keeping them up, but they are desperately short of goals, and I think, you know, it's a cheap option for them. He knows the club, he's been there before, he's done pretty well in the past, particularly with Tim Cahill not having scored for a year. I think it, in the circumstances, makes some sense.
Welcome back, Landon. Stevie Keane gets a respite from nasty banners at Ewood Park at the weekend as he loses 2-1 to West Brom. But no respite from the local media, with the Lancashire Telegraph coming out on Monday calling for his resignation. Now, I don't remember stuff like this happening very often, that a newspaper comes out and calls for somebody's resignation. Ben, you're a newspaper boss. What do you make of this?
I think when something like this happens, you realise we've reached a tipping point. I think the end is nigh, Steve. I think it's been coming for a long time. But when you reach this kind of a situation, when the local community and the fans and everyone is so against you, you can't ignore what's obvious to everyone else. He won't be manager of Blackburn for very much longer.
But why should he resign? Shouldn't he wait for Venky's to sack him?
I think they will. Gab, one for you. I hear Inter Milan are no longer champions of the world, which means Rafa is no longer champion manager of the world. Who holds the title now?
Well, the title of champions of the world is now held by Barcelona, who of course beat Santos 4-0 at the weekend in the FIFA Club World Cup. Now, you can say it's just a tin pop, blah, 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 but Santos were really banking on this. I mean, Pelé came out and said Neymar was better than Messi. They spent a lot of money to hang on to Neymar and Ganso and their other stars. They spent money to bring Alano back and Edu Dracena back. They really, really wanted this. And on the pitch, it was just nothing. I mean, Barcelona were 3-0 up and it hit the post by halftime. I don't think this is a knock on Brazilian football or South American football. It's just further confirmation that right now, Barcelona are one of the greatest sides ever. That's all we've got time for this week, but you can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis. My web chat's on Tuesdays, Ollie K's web chat's on Wednesdays. Plus, we're all on Twitter. You know where to find us. Till next week. Bye-bye.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.